Okay, so let's get started. Let me just make the opening spiel so the person that gets stuck having to type up this tape knows what it is. It's August 11th, 2010, and we're interviewing Mr. Tom Baxter from the New York Fed. Mr. Baxter, thank you for taking the time to talk to me and my colleagues, if any of them ever show up into my office, because they're not here yet. As Sherry probably told you, I wanted to follow up on some of the stuff Dixie asked you about related to Lehman. So I'm not interested in talking to you about AIG today. I know that's what she primarily talked about. And so I guess what I first want to do is talk to you about the weekend, and just first generally tell me what happened in terms of the deal falling apart. And let me tell you what I do know, since I know time is short, and this will maybe help shorten it up. I mean, we have heard that the private consortium did reach agreement to finance $40 to $50 billion of the lousy assets. Lousy is my word. And that Barclays was willing to do the deal with those assets carved out. And then, you know, we've heard about the shareholder guarantee, or the guarantee and the request to waive the shareholder vote for it, and that's apparently what killed it. So I want to hear your views on what happened there. And then two, once that did happen, if you could help us understand why Lehman was then unable to use what we've heard were new rules under the PDCF that would have allowed, as we've been told anyway, a broader range of collateral types to secure borrowings under the PDCF. So if you could address those two things, I would greatly appreciate it.
Sure, Chris, I'll be happy to. And let me back up and start out with the meeting we convened Friday night at the Fed. We had all of the major institutions here. The meeting began with a statement by the Treasury Secretary at the time, Hank Paulson. He basically made it clear to the assembled institutions that Friday night that we were going to work through the weekend to come up with a solution. If we didn't find a solution by the end of the weekend, then we would be facing a Lehman bankruptcy. And work began in earnest Friday night by the assembled to find a solution. The early outline of what a solution would look like was really modeled after what we did with Bear Stearns in March of 2008.
Right.
So the idea was to find a merger partner, to find a way to take bad assets out of the acquired institution, and to make it acceptable to the acquiring institution. Mm-hmm. As of Friday night, we had two potential acquirers. They were Barclays and Bank of America. And it was on Saturday that we learned that Bank of America was going to run off with a different bride, to use a metaphor.
Right.
And that bride was Merrill Lynch. So it was on Saturday that we realized, we the governmental people involved, that our options were going to be limited to Barclays Bank. And Barclays was a little different in that it was a UK charter. But things looked rather promising as we were moving into Saturday night and the early hours of Sunday morning, in that Barclays was interested in acquiring all of Lehman, that while there was originally some stiff resistance by some of the CEOs to financing an acquisition by a competitor, the CEOs had ultimately come round to realize that that was probably in their interest, and that the alternative, which was a Lehman bankruptcy, was perceived to be worse.
Mm-hmm.
And by early Sunday, we had commitments from the consortium to essentially finance bad commercial real estate that would come out of Lehman, and that was the principal financial problem in Lehman was its commercial real estate portfolio. And it seemed that Barclays would be able to go forward like Chase did with Bear 6 months before and buy all of Lehman.
Right.
Now, what happened on Sunday is we learned that there was a problem with the acquisition, and the problem with the acquisition related to a guarantee. Now, let me give you a little bit of information about that guarantee.
Sure.
Again, if you go back to the model for what we were pursuing in September, it was a rescue of Lehman similar to the rescue of Bear Stearns. And if you look at the architecture of the rescue of Bear Stearns, a key piece of that rescue involved Chase guaranteeing the trading obligations of Bear Stearns between merger contract, which was in March, and merger closing, which was in June. And if you go back and you look at the Bear Stearns transaction, you'll see, and for lawyers this is of particular interest, that there was a lot of controversy surrounding the guarantee that Wachtell drafted, because they drafted it incorrectly. So there's press about the guarantee. It's an uncomfortable story for Wachtell, but the key feature of that guarantee is that it is uncapped and it is unsecured. All right?
Uh-huh.
So when we got to September and we were talking to Barclays, we knew that we had an issue that needed to be solved, and that was we had to keep the counterparties of Lehman trading with Lehman between merger contract and merger closing. And to achieve that, we knew we needed a guarantee from Barclays similar to the guarantee that Chase proffered for Bear. So a key element to make this transaction effective was the guarantee. And it was in that context that we heard on Sunday that Barclays could not proffer the guarantee like Chase did. And as one of the people in the room, I was like stunned that we should be hearing about that for the first time on Sunday. It was clear to everyone that we were pursuing a path similar to the path we took with Bear Stearns and Chase, and there was no secret that to hold a transaction together between contract and closing, we needed a guarantee. So there was a lot of concern as to why are we hearing about this now? What's the real problem? And in my view, as I sit here today, the real problem was the degree of discomfort from the British government with the transaction. Because we did go back and say, well, look, if there's a reason, if there's a need for a shareholder vote on the guarantee, perhaps the FSA can waive that requirement of a shareholder vote. There's got to be a legal solution so that we can get this transaction to yes. And I can tell you, as one of the people in the room, that we never got an acceptable solution to this problem, and it became clear that Barclays could not, would not, and was not legally permitted to proffer the guarantee, and that became the problem as to why this transaction didn't go forward.
So let me ask you about that, because what we've heard is that in terms of that guarantee, putting aside the issue, at least for now, of what are you talking about, asking about the guarantee now, everybody's always known this was going to be part of the deal. We've also heard that once that did occur, then, you know, one of the things that was asked was, well, can the FSA do something to waive the requirement for the shareholders to approve that guarantee feature? Can you talk about that?
certainly that question was asked. I certainly asked that question. You know, I'm a U.S. lawyer. I'm not a U.K. lawyer, so I don't know the answer. As I sit here today, I still don't know the answer as to whether the FSA could have waived. I know the result, and that is that no one in the British government was willing to waive, and we never did get a waiver of this requirement, so we knew at a point in time on Sunday that no guarantee was going to be forthcoming, and that's why we kind of ran out of gas on the facilitated rescue operation, and that left us with the bankruptcy alternative.
Understanding you're an American lawyer and don't know if the shareholder approval requirement could be waived, do you know if shareholder approval was really required?
I've been told it's required. I have never actually gone and looked at the British law to see if that is in fact the case. My sense, Chris, then and now, is that our problem was resistance from the British government, and it wasn't about the law. It was about the policy. It was about the British being concerned that they would catch the American cancer, that their charter, Barclays, was going to be taking on an American problem that was Lehman. But again, I'm speculating in giving you that answer, but it is my belief.
Okay. You know, I haven't seen it, but somebody that we interviewed told us that I guess there's some documentary that was done in the UK where I think it was Darling, who said, and by the way, I do have some colleagues in my office now, Joe B., Art Wilmeth, and Donna Norman, who, Sherry, I think you at least know who they are. But apparently Darling says in this documentary, you know, we were willing to do the deal. We just weren't willing to do the deal if the U.S. government wasn't willing to participate in some way. And you ever hear any discussions or aware of anything in that regard?
Yeah, well, of course. One of the options would have been, one of the perceived options is, why doesn't the Fed do the guarantee? And the answer to that is, first, Fed has no legal authority to do what I'll characterize as a naked guarantee, that is an uncapped, unlimited, and unsecured guarantee obligation. All right? So the first point is we can't do a guarantee like Chase did in the Bear deal. Second is, could we have done a secured guarantee? The answer to that is probably we could have, but for a guarantee of a merger involving an acquiring institution with $850 billion in assets, how much collateral would you need? And the answer would be hundreds of millions of dollars of collateral, and there wasn't enough to do that. So, you know, the short answer is the Fed couldn't do what Chase did and what Barclays needed to do.
Go ahead.
So the British expectation might be that the Fed should do the guarantee, but there is no capacity for us to do that.
So when you say that you didn't have the Fed didn't have the authority to do an unsecured guarantee like Chase did, are you referring to Section 13.3?
Yes. Now, Section 13.3 requires us to be secured to our satisfaction.
Right.
And for the obligor in a guarantee transaction, that is the guarantor would have been facing uncapped liability for Lehman's entire trading book, right?
Uh-huh.
So we're talking hundreds of billions of dollars of guarantee liability, and secure to our satisfaction means fully secured, first priority, perfected security interest. And for that, you would need hundreds of billions of dollars in collateral. So, you know, no way we could do that. So, you know, here we were in a situation very similar to what we faced in March with Bear Stearns, except that we had a private sector consortium willing to finance, not the Fed, so better off in September, and the deal falls because of the guarantee.
Mr. Baxter, this is Art Wilmarth. Just to follow up a little bit on that, at the point when some combination of Barclays and the FSA were balking on the idea of Barclays giving a guarantee, at that point, did they specifically discuss with you, well, can the Fed come in and do something? Was that actually a part of the conversation you had with Barclays and or the FSA people?
No. With Barclays, I was talking to Raj Cohen at Sullivan and Cromwell, and Raj and I have known each other for a long time. My conversations with Raj were along the lines that, Raj, I can't believe that we're going to lose this because of the guarantee. There's got to be a way under British law we can find, that Barclays can find, to do the guarantee. And it was sometime on Sunday that Raj told me that wasn't going to happen.
Did Raj...
With respect to the discussion about legal authority, that would have been a discussion I had with my client.
Okay, so at least as you recall, Raj did not ask you, can the Fed come in and fill the gap, essentially, to make this transaction happen?
To the best of my recollection, he did not. Now, Raj is sophisticated enough to know that under 13.3, the Fed has to be fully secure. So,
well,
and Raj was also involved, by the way, in the Bear Stearns deal. So he and I had been down this path once before. And that's why I said, for the benefit of you all, that there was no secret here what we needed, because Raj and I had already done one of these deals. We knew we needed the acquiring institution, which was Barclays, to guarantee the trading obligations of the acquired between merger contract and merger closing. And we knew that because we did it once before.
Now, you know, Raj, of course, was involved in drafting the expansion of 13.3 in 1991. At least I think he's indicated to us and perhaps to others that he viewed the security to the satisfaction requirement as being quite flexible, more flexible than you've described it. Did you have discussions with him, you know, at Bear or later, indicating that this first priority, fully secured, was the Fed's sort of unshakable view of what secured to the satisfaction meant?
I don't remember having that specific conversation, but I'd be surprised if Raj had a view that we would do anything less than fully secured.
We've looked at, obviously, 13.3, and we've even seen... or at least someone here has seen, I haven't looked at it, the memo that I think Mr. Alvarez wrote, that does say, I mean, the statutory text is pretty clear in terms of providing, you know, broad flexibility. And I hear you saying, though, and all I'm trying to get at is, I see what the statutory text says, but regardless of that, is it policy of the Fed that, you know, look, even though the statutory text gives us flexibility and you could read into that we don't need to be fully secured, nevertheless, the policy at the Fed is we need to be fully secured?
The statutory language is secured to our satisfaction.
Mm-hmm.
In discussions with client, and I know we've waived privilege here, that I've always said, why would you be satisfied at anything less than you could demand, and that is a first priority, fully perfected security interest? Why would you take less? Now, there may be policy reasons in some case where you might want to be less than fully secured, but remember the explanation you're going to have to give to some future congressional committee is why you put the taxpayers of the United States at risk. And it seems to me that if you have that kind of dialogue with your clients, they're going to quickly understand that the only real position you can take is you want to be perfected like you would in a commercial transaction, and that means first priority perfected security interest.
Sure, and I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead.
And particularly here, where you're facilitating an acquisition by a British institution of Lehman, it seems to me that in this particular case, that would be where you would have to come out. And the demands of this situation were absolutely clear. We required Chase to give an uncapped, unsecured guarantee in the Bear transaction. Why less here?
Well, I'm sorry. I keep jumping in when you're not done. Go ahead. I'm sorry. So let me ask you then. I mean, you know, obviously the policy reason that you might do something that wasn't the same as the J.P. Morgan Bear Stearns deal is sort of the obvious thing, and that is, what are the systemic implications of letting Lehman file bankruptcy, which I know from documents and other interviews was exactly what you guys were looking at and concerned about. So can you maybe comment on what kind of discussions there were with, look, you know, the policy is, and everybody knows the policy is, or the requirement is, or the text requires, and this is the deal we did with Bear Stearns and J.P. Morgan, that we have to be fully secured, and that we're not comfortable doing an open-ended, you know, multi-hundred-billion-dollar guarantee, you know, that's going to require hundreds of billions of dollars of collateral, and even then isn't going to be close to fully secured, versus, but if we don't do that, what are the repercussions from letting this $800 billion institution file bankruptcy?
Yeah, and the dynamics of the situation where the first line would have been, we gave the uncapped, unsecured guarantee like Chase did, that we did that for the facilitation of the Lehman transaction. That would have put hundreds of billions of taxpayer money at risk. And we still would have had the risk that, you know, in the end, Barclays might not have gone forward with the deal. Remember, because it has the incentive of getting the shareholder vote approving the merger transaction going forward, but it doesn't have the liability because that's all been offloaded onto the taxpayers of the U.S. So in the end, you might have been guaranteeing the trading obligations of an entity that died anyway. So, you know, it seems to me that for people who really understand the dynamics of this particular merger transaction, it would have been more than foolish for the Federal Reserve to give a guarantee of Lehman in that instance, similar to the guarantee Chase did in Bear. Remember, when Chase is doing the guarantee, Chase is also the acquiring institution which has every incentive to get the merger done.
Right.
If you had the United States government, the taxpayers of the U.S., guaranteeing the trading obligations of Lehman, and Barclays in the position of, well, maybe I want to go forward with this acquisition, but maybe I won't in the end, and maybe I won't get my shareholders to approve, that is a totally different transaction, and one that I think would be inherently unsafe and unsound for the government to do.
So,
in fact, we didn't do it,
right?
Because we're not fools. It would have been an incredible foolhardy thing to do, and in my view, you know, I just can't see us taking that kind of huge risk with taxpayer money.
To the extent that you recall, when you were sort of looking at the possibility of the whole deal falling apart at this point. Do you recall the principals discussing, you know, what the likely market ramifications would be if Lehman failed, if Lehman, you know, didn't open the next day and went into bankruptcy instead? I mean, was there some extended discussion of what the downside risks were?
Oh, no question about that. The principals, and let me be clear, I'm talking about Chairman Bernanke, Tim Geithner, and Hank Paulson. Were fixed on the systemic effects of a Lehman bankruptcy that throughout the weekend and before. The whole reason we called this extraordinary meeting at the New York Fed were because we had run out of options and we knew bankruptcy was around the corner and we had been thinking about the systemic consequences of that bankruptcy particularly in view of the context of the time, and were very, very worried about it, and that's why this extraordinary meeting was called. So there was multiple conversations that I was involved in with the principals, where the prospects in terms of systemic effects of a Lehman bankruptcy were not only discussed, but were discussed and a topic of very significant concern.
There seems to have been a great deal of focus on the tri-party repos market, and some degree of focus on OTC derivatives. In the documents that I've looked at, there seems to have been, I wouldn't say not much focus, but at least less focus on impacts in overseas markets, including derivatives markets, and almost no discussion of the commercial paper market. Do you remember whether the impact of the overseas derivatives and other markets and the impact on the commercial paper market were reviewed and considered, as you were sort of standing in the precipice here, is it fair to say?
Yeah. And I know you'll get some of my notes later on, but some of those notes relate to discussions that took place over Lehman weekend with the CEOs. And I remember the CEO, Bob Kelly, of Bank of New York Mellon in particular, had great concern about the commercial paper market. So the answer to your question is yes, that we had some information about that. It came, and a lot of this information did come from the CEOs themselves as we talked about the problem through the weekend, and as they came to realize that it was in their interest to finance this acquisition by a competitor that was Barclays. The only way they got there is because they too started to see some of the systemic consequences that we were concerned about, and these are sophisticated market players, and with respect to commercial paper specifically, since that's what you asked about, as I sit here today, I do recall, and I think you'll see it in my notes, that Bob in particular was focused on that issue, and he turned out to be right when we learned the following week with the reserve fund that some of the problems with respect to the knock-on consequences of Lehman's Chapter 11 filing.
Just to go back to the consortium a little bit, can you sketch out the terms, the basic terms of the consortium deal, and whether the Fed was going to give any liquidity backstop or other support to the consortium? This may be obvious from other materials. I'm just not familiar with it personally.
Okay. Again, the way the meeting began was with a statement by Paulson, and he basically outlined the problem, and then he said to the assembled institutions, and you all need to understand that unlike the last time, this time not 1 cent of government money will support this deal. You're here because that's your job. And so the way the meeting began is the meeting began with a description of the Lehman problem, a description of the deadline that was close of the weekend. We were either going to have a rescue or we were going to have a bankruptcy. And that unlike the last time, that was bare, not a penny of taxpayer money would be in this deal. So everyone in the consortium was told at the outset that they were there to provide the financing. And they noticed very soon that there were two institutions that were not in the room, and they were Bank of America and Barclays. And the reason Bank of America and Barclays were not in the room is because they were the candidates to take the position of Chase in the Bear deal. And so the options were left with the consortium to figure out how best to do this, how best to facilitate a merger transaction. And, it wasn't rocket science for the people in the room to know that in the Bear deal, the Fed took the bad assets into a vehicle, Maiden Lane, that it financed with Chase. And so, you know, the architecture for what we were pursuing over Lehman Weekend was similar, that you could create a vehicle, a Delaware limited liability company. You could lend to that vehicle, and that vehicle could buy bad commercial real estate assets from Lehman and facilitate the merger of Lehman into either Barclays or Bank of America. So it was pretty early on that the consortium recognized how this could be done. The key question is, what would those assets be worth, and how much financing would be provided by the consortium? And you know, you can appreciate that here again, we're getting into the issue of financing and how it's secured. And so the consortium, no fools in the room there, they're looking to try to value the assets, and we're talking about commercial real estate assets at a point in time when it's very hard to value those assets. Remember, Fannie and Freddie had been put into conservatorship the week before. So we're in uncertain times. We've got valuation questions. We've got financing to be provided, and the banks wanting to be secured by the assets they would be taking into a vehicle. And so most of the discussion centered on valuing those assets and how much financing the banks would be willing to provide. Now, of course, they hated the whole idea, right? Because they didn't want to be doing for a competitor what the Fed did in the Bear deal. But they were told that was those were the alternatives, and they shouldn't come back and even suggest for a moment that the Fed should be participating or the Treasury should be participating. This time it was for them. Now that technique of forcing them to finance, that worked, because by Sunday they had gotten to yes on the financing and on the assets.
And what numbers were we looking at?
The deal failed was not for the financing. It failed because of the guarantee.
And just generally, you know, dollar amount of assets, dollar amount of financing, dollar amount of Lehman equity being contributed to the SPE, do you know, remember that offhand?
You know, and again, there are notes on this. Mm-hmm. The idea was $40 to $50 billion in financing. And then there was a whole pool of commercial real estate assets that would be put into the vehicle and secure the lending.
Okay.
And you know, lots of talk. There was a whole subgroup that was working on the valuation of those assets. But I can't remember, as I sit here today, what the ultimate number assigned was.
Was the ultimate number assigned greater than the amount of financing?
I think they were close, but okay. I don't hold me to that. I don't remember the numbers exactly.
Okay, let me ask you this. I want to ask you about what you know on an ex ante basis about what you thought the repercussions of a bankruptcy would be. And on that score, we've heard from other folks that Lehman actually had this PowerPoint presentation that included some slides on here's what the repercussions of a Lehman bankruptcy may be, that they were using to trying to persuade you folks to do something other than let Lehman file bankruptcy once the Barclays deal went away. And then what you have seen as the repercussions of the Lehman bankruptcy on a ex post basis. So could you address that?
Yeah, you know, putting myself back into that time, my first thought was the worst thing we could experience would be the prospect of a merger goes away and Lehman doesn't file. And we open Monday morning in complete chaos.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that was the worst scenario. Our plan, at least speaking for the Fed, was the better option was a Chapter 11 petition by the parent. And the you know, this was not our best option. Our best option would have been a facilitated acquisition. And that was because of the systemic consequences we were worrying about. But then our next option was the parent files Chapter 11. We keep the U.S. broker-dealer in operation, with Federal Reserve liquidity and slowly work down the book of the U.S. broker-dealer to try to mitigate the systemic consequences we knew were coming. And that was the plan. That was our plan B. And that was what we set out to do on Monday morning. Now, that changed when Barclays came back to the table. But until Barclays came back, our contingency plan was Chapter 11 filing by the parent of Lehman, keep the U.S. broker-dealer in operation, wind down its trading book over several weeks, and then when we felt we had gotten the broker-dealer to the point where we could put it into a SIFIC receivership without the horrible consequences that we feared on Monday, then that's what would happen.
And so, you know, we've heard about, you know, this...
By the way, gentlemen, that was a plan. That was our plan.
Right.
We had developed that plan over the preceding week with the SEC, and it was clearly the contingency plan. It was where we were going to go if we couldn't facilitate a rescue, and it was ultimately the plan that we wound up running.
And so we've heard that, you know, there was an unwinding of derivative contracts between Lehman and various American or U.S.-based counterparties, but I'm still unclear on whether or not that was something that happened during this weekend, or is that part of something that's happening through this, you know, keeping the broker-dealer open, you know, when the parent files? Do you know? Can you address that?
I'm sorry, I was distracted. I didn't hear the question.
Yeah, Chris, just so you know, we have about a minute.
Okay.
So if this is your, you know, major question, Tom will give you an answer on it, but we do have to cut this now.
Okay. That's. Let me ask you this, Mr. Baxter. When are you back in the country?
I'm back on Thursday morning.
Okay. Could we talk
tomorrow,
to you again?
Next Thursday morning.
Yeah, I didn't think you were going to Europe and coming back tomorrow. Can we talk to you then? Since
well,
we have one minute.
How long do you have to go? Because I mean, we can.
15 minutes, 30 minutes, probably.
Let me check what we can do here. Can you hang up for one sec?
Sure. They told me this yesterday that he had a flight to catch, and I said I'll take the 30 minutes. Well, he's actually given us some pretty good information. Yeah.
Chris,
yes.
In the interest of saving Mr. Baxter from a follow-up interview, just because when he returns, his calendar is going to be much crazier even than it is today, we can push back what he had at 12:30 to about 12:45. If you can get this done in 15 minutes, we can
Let's try. All right, so could you address that then, this issue of unwinding the derivative contracts? Was that something that was done pre-bankruptcy filing, or is that done through keeping the broker-dealer open, or both?
The question is the derivatives book in the broker-dealer?
Yeah, or are you even just not within the broker-dealer? But we have heard, and I think it's even been written about, that, you know, a lot of the derivative contracts were netted out and wound down or signed to other parties before Lehman actually filed bankruptcy, you know, and that's why there weren't as many derivative contracts to deal with when the filing occurred. But I don't know that that's the case, and I don't know that maybe that was done by the broker-dealer staying open with the PDCF money once the parent did file bankruptcy. If you know about that, great. If you don't, then that's what it is.
Yeah, Chris, let me answer that. I don't know the answer to the question. Now, over Lehman weekend, we had a group of bankruptcy lawyers and representatives of the consortium work on the bankruptcy options.
Mm-hmm.
It's possible that I wasn't in that group. I was in the CEO group.
Mm-hmm.
But it's possible that group did look at the derivatives book. I remember that at the end of that analysis, and I remember Fran Bermanzon from Goldman, a lawyer at Goldman, was one of the people who was involved in that group, that I heard back that our overall plan of Chapter 11 petition by the parents, keep the broker-dealer alive, that was the best of the option. No one came up with a better option, because the charge to the bankruptcy lawyers was, you know, you guys see if you can find a better option. Mm-hmm. But as we see it, that's our best contingency plan. My understanding is that after a full day of discussion, the bankruptcy lawyers couldn't come up with anything better. Now, whether they took up the derivatives question or not, I just don't know. I wasn't in that group.
Okay. Let me ask you about, you know, I said a little earlier that some folks we've talked to from Lehman about this PowerPoint presentation and them, you know, trying to convince you folks that, you know, we know you don't want to make an unsecured loan, and we know you wish Barclays was doing this, but the systemic implications are really bad, and you guys, we need to figure something out other than a Lehman bankruptcy. Do you recall that, and recall what the reaction was?
I don't recall a deck. You know, I had multiple conversations with McDade. I don't think I spoke to Fold over the weekend. I would have spoken to Russo, I think, but I don't remember a deck as I sit here.
Okay. Did you talk to Harvey Miller at all?
Yes.
I mean, I don't know if it was him or if I read it in the press, but there's supposedly the infamous comment of it's going to be friggin', and I don't think it was friggin', Armageddon, if Lehman filed. Do you recall anything like that?
I remember Harvey saying that, but let me give you my context for that discussion. Once the Barclays prospect went off the table, mm-hmm. it became clear that we were going to have to run our contingency plan, which was bankruptcy. Mm-hmm. Now Lehman was in denial at that point in time. There was no way they believed that this story ends with a Lehman bankruptcy, that they kept thinking that they were going to be bailed out by the taxpayer of the United States. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm not trying to convince you that that belief was a crazy belief, because they had seen that happen in the Bear case. But I knew from my clients that that was not going to happen. And so from my point of view, I had to convince Harvey that bankruptcy was where we were going, and he had to convince his client. You know, that's the context. And of course, you know, like any good lawyer, he's in the position of trying to play the government. Now, we knew the consequences were going to be bad, but we weren't going to put the taxpayer at risk. Mm-hmm. So the problem was, you know, you had to get Lehman to focus that there was not going to be a bailout here, and not to allow us to drift into Monday morning and complete chaos, and so they had to look at the situation, assume away a bailout by the taxpayer, and then reach the hard decision, which means we got to file. Mm-hmm. So the dynamics of the situation were first meeting with the Lehman people late on Sunday and trying to get them to understand that they weren't going to be rescued, and then focus on what their real options were, which were drift into Monday morning with nothing done and then have chaos break out, or alternatively file.
Right.
And so from my point of view, first thing was to convince Harvey that it was far better to file than to go into Monday and have complete pandemonium break out. And then he had to have discussions with the Lehman board, because they had a fiduciary duty to resolve what was in the best interests of the company and its shareholders and other stakeholders. So those are the interaction with Harvey. From my perspective, you have to understand what I was trying to do, and I knew that the consequences were going to be bad. That wasn't an issue. And at one point, he might have said Armageddon. But of course he's going to say that, because he's trying to lever the government into reconsidering whether it's going to rescue Lehman.
Right.
And the answer was, we were beyond that point.
Mr. Baxter, I'm looking at this revised liquidation consortium game plan that was sent out by Michael Nelson late on the 10th to a group of folks, including yourself. And one thing that interests me about that document is that although it clearly says that the opening position of the Fed and the Treasury was going to be no taxpayer help, I mean no help to the consortium, it clearly indicates that you were having in mind some kind of either liquidity backstop or some kind of financial backstop to help the consortium if it came to that. And does that game plan, reflect what your actual thinking was, or is that not an accurate reflection of what your thinking was?
That's a draft document that you're looking at, prepared by Michael Nelson, who reports to me. He's one of my lawyers. He was charged with coming up with an outline of what we might do on the weekend. What we ultimately did do is reflected in the handwritten notes that you will receive from us. And you will see that when the assembled were called in on that Friday night, they were told that there would not be government assistance.
So that's what
actually happened was, and this is in part technique, is to get those people focused. They had to understand that it was on them.
No, I understand. It was a good negotiating tactic. I guess my question.
It worked.
Right. And I guess my question is, did your principals ever disavow this notion that if push came to shove, in other words, if it was going to take some kind of financial help to get that consortium done, assuming that you could get Barclays where you needed to get them, that financial help, would be given? Or did the principals say, no, I mean, we're essentially not adopting this part of the game plan?
And the important point to understand with respect to that issue is at no point in time was anyone told that the existing Federal Reserve facilities would not be available, all right? And one of those facilities was the primary dealer credit facility. So that facility was in existence when the consortium was having its conversations with the government. We never told them that facility was not available to Lehman's broker-dealer, its primary dealer. And in fact, when we went to our contingency plan, the primary dealer credit facility was the facility that we used to extend secured credit to Lehman's broker-dealer. So important points to know going in is that the way this was presented was there would be no taxpayer assistance provided to facilitate the merger, but at the same time, no one was told that existing Federal Reserve facilities could not be used.
And just to follow up on that, when you get to the point where Barclays is balking on the guarantee point, did you ever consider the possibility that, well, If you go to Plan B, you're going to have to put something like $60 billion of PDCF facility out there to go to Plan B. How much worse would it be? And you've got the consortium lined up to take care of the real estate assets. How much worse would it be to go to Plan A and provide some kind of bridge guarantee that would allow...
Well, going back to the discussion we just had, involving an uncapped, unlimited, unsecured guarantee and having no ability to make the transaction happen, which I think would have been an incredibly foolish thing for the government to do. Contrast that to making a fully secured by good collateral loan at the PDCF. And that is something we did do. That is something that not only were we fully repaid on, but we made money on it because of the interest involved. and in the end was effective to try to get the broker-dealer into friendly hands. That was ultimately Barclays, and that also worked out. You know, that's one of the good pieces of what we did with respect to Lima. That particular part worked well, but it's worlds apart contrasting a fully secured loan at the PDCF, fully secured overnight loan, to an unlimited, uncapped guarantee, which hinges on a transaction that you have no ability to make happen. You know, those are very, very different things. And, you know, one is not only commercially reasonable, but probably good, and the other is commercially unreasonable.
So let me
probably unsafe and unsound.
Hey, Chris and I, this is Dave Gunton. I think it's a little bit past quarter till. If you guys have maybe one more question, we could probably handle that, but I think we really need to cut it off.
Okay, well, let me throw two out there, and I'll ask them together and see if you can answer both of them. If not, you know, we'll deal with it. But one is, we've heard that, you know, on that Sunday or Monday that the Fed had expanded the types of collateral that were available to secure PDCF borrowings, but that those new collateral rules, Lehman was told they would not apply to Lehman, one. So that's my first question. Is that the case? What do you know about that? And two, I hear you saying, you know, over and over again that the message to the consortium and others was, look, no government money this time, like in Bear. Why? What was the reason for that stance? And I will tell you, I mean, and you, I'm sure you know this, it's been written all over in the financial press and otherwise, that, you know, Mr. Paulson and others are taking a lot of grief, you know, since providing money to Bear and since making the bazooka comment about the GSEs and then having to put them into conservatorship the previous weekend. So if you could answer, if you can, if you have the time to answer those two, that would be great.
Okay. First point about that Lehman didn't benefit from the same expansion of the collateral pool, my belief is that's wrong, that there is a letter, I think it's from Chris Burke, here at the Fed, which says you do have the benefit of that expanded collateral pool. I think, you know, it just may be explained in terms of people who hadn't slept in days at Lehman not being aware of the right communication. On the second issue about no government money, you know, there I think the principal criticism that I've heard with respect to the Bear Stearns deal is that we didn't work hard enough to get the creditor community of Bear Stearns putting skin in the game. And so the technique when we went into Lehman weekend was to get the creditors accepting responsibility. It's, you know, I've said this to the Lehman Examiner, it's more reminiscent of what we did in long-term capital management back in the summer of 98. And, you know, I've been at the Fed for 30 years, so I've been through a lot of these. And there, what the technique is to get the creditors to see that in their enlightened self-interest, they should put money up and save themselves from the consequences of a bankruptcy.
Okay.
That was what we were trying to do in Lehman. And again, I think we were successful. We achieved that particular mission. What we didn't achieve was getting the actual merger done. And you know, I wish that we had succeeded with that, but it was because of the guarantee and not because of the financing.
Mr. Baxter, thank you for taking the time with us. I very much appreciate it. Sherry, when you have a chance, give me a ring later on today, and I want to talk about a couple of things if you have a chance.
Hey, Chris, Sherry, just had to step out for a second, but I'll be sure to pass it.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chris, sorry to have to rush this.
No, I appreciate your time.
All righty.
Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Hold on.